Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. The everyday expression of race relations in American society is largely a question of etiquette, of the accepted patterns of behavior and contact that shape the interaction of men and women from different racial backgrounds. We may not automatically think of it this way because so much of this behavior is easily assumed, but it would be wrong to think of this aspect of race relations as inconsequential or solely symbolic. In fact, the rules, codes, and taboos of this racial etiquette contribute strongly to the national social fabric and help define the way we live. My guest is Elizabeth Lash Quinn, Associate Professor of History at Syracuse University. Elizabeth, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much.
This is a fascinating topic that you're working on, and I dare say one of the most important for all of us in this American society. And perhaps the fundamental question, Elizabeth, to begin with, is the whole relationship of etiquette to how a society functions. I mean, I've gotten the impression that particularly in a democratic society, it has a lot to do with civility and community. And we may not often think of it that way, but, well, I guess that's the question. Should we?
I think we should. I think we've lost our moorings, in a sense, by throwing out the idea that etiquette is important. Part of the 20th century revolt against formality and rules and structure, it both in the 1920s and then especially later in the 1960s, has been a questioning of etiquette in general, in a sense that it's somehow an elite phenomenon. And that's actually a long-standing question that Americans have dealt with. What is the role of etiquette in a democratic society? Many people have thought it's sort of a relic of a more elite kind of society or hierarchical society, like a monarchy, for instance, where you have a nobility. I think that one of the burning questions of the whole democratic experiment, which we are still undergoing, is whether is there an etiquette that's appropriate to a democratic society? Is it even an important question? And I would say, yes, it is crucial.
Now, if we were to take our interracial behavior, that is to say the etiquette of race relations, so to speak, as a component of this overall question of etiquette in American society, would it be your position that there have been substantial changes in it, in the etiquette of race relations over, let's say, the last three decades from what it was previously?
Yes, absolutely. Without a doubt, there has been a change, but there are certain ways that the prevailing etiquette, I think, in the late 20th century, in our own time, strangely carries over some of the worst aspects of the racial etiquette before that time, even though we like to think we have advanced a great deal. And I think in many ways we clearly have made tremendous advances with the coming of the civil rights movement and its aftermath. But, because if you think about the interracial etiquette before the 1950s and 60s, that was the very rigid, hierarchical etiquette of Jim Crow, of segregation. And that, in turn, was very much a kind of carryover of some of the etiquette of slavery and just the worst social constellations that the country has ever seen.
Right.
And so, yeah, there was a fundamental double standard underlying the interracial etiquette of Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. And we like to think that we've gotten well beyond that. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, I think we are carrying over the separation of morality and etiquette. Or some people see that as the difference between manners and morals.
The obvious next question is if you could help us think by way of examples of, you know, what has changed, what hasn't changed, and what are the costs perhaps of this contradiction or blending of opposites?
Okay. Well, What has changed is that enormous advances have been made in the realms, clearly, of legal rights and citizenship rights. And most people who consider themselves to be true to the democratic idea couldn't tolerate ever in the future a society that denied those basic civil rights to any group at all.
That's clearly a result of the civil rights movement.
Yes, I think absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that movement, of course, had ramifications throughout the world. So we can't possibly underestimate the tremendous advances that we've seen in our time and that we benefit from. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if one is truly inspired by that civil rights vision, one has to look around our society currently and ask if we are completely, if we've fulfilled that dream, the dream of people like Martin Luther King and all of the various people who fought for something much more than just constitutional, the fulfillment of constitutional promises, but fought for what was called in the early civil rights movement a beloved community, and what some other people envisioned, who wouldn't actually use the word beloved, but envisioned as a newly made American society that was much truer to democracy than what we ended up with. And I think part of what happened was that the civil rights movement went awry, basically, that by the late 60s it had a crisis of confidence and a crisis of self-definition.
I want to, in a moment, probe some of those changes in the later civil rights movement you alluded to, because I think that's a very fundamental thing. But when you speak of the unspoken tensions, I think is a phrase that you might be comfortable with, that seems to me to suggest, at least in part, some of the carryover you were talking about from sort of the preceding unhappy racial ethic of the slavery and segregation years. But I don't want to answer your question. What does it mean? What are these underlying tensions? And to what degree do they reflect, in fact, a carryover of pre-existing attitudes on race?
These unresolved tensions, I think, have to do with almost everything that this country has inherited about race. I think the most important thing, or one of the most important ways to look at this is that we like to think that we're tremendously advanced, that somehow the 1990s sounds like a great enlightened age, whereas in 50 years it will sound a bit archaic and old-fashioned. And I think it's important to distance ourselves from that sense of progress, that somehow we are so much more enlightened now. Because if we really stand back and think about it, we are still very much in the phase of adjustment to integration. We've only been an integrated society for such a short time. And yet we leave all of the issues about integration unresolved or unexplored. And because I think that they are so troubling, sometimes they seem that there is no resolution, but I think there very much is one, and it has to do with the democratic tradition of this country, and which was the whole inspiration for the civil rights movement. And it has to do with bridging the manners and morals that we live by.
So, that's a very good point. And if that is true, then are we still, and you point out that we are, 1999 is not as late as sometimes we like to think it is. Are we still beholden, perhaps as a society, to some of the mythologies and so forth developed in the slavery and segregation eras?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, we really are. It would be great if we could say that we weren't, and certainly they have changed and evolved and such, but still, I think they linger on, and they sort of got a renewed lease on life, unfortunately. And that's what worries me the most, is that when we try new policies and such, for instance, affirmative action, we have to think about ways that new policies might actually extend the life of old myths and such that we are trying to get rid of. And if we use that as a guide to what kinds of things we want to do in the future, it would help us a lot more than just finding things that seem like good solutions, but might just be short-term solutions mm-hmm. that actually perpetuate problems. Mm-hmm. For instance, just with that policy alone, affirmative action is a very complex policy, and I don't want to say that it's usually discussing it gets reduced to either advocating it or going against it, and I don't want to do that at all. But here's a policy that undeniably brought many people who before that could not gain employment into realms that they where they had very important jobs, and that has changed the look of this nation in many wonderful ways. But on the other hand, because there were, even if it was a very small number of situations where people who weren't fully qualified ended up getting a job over someone else who was, say, non-black, the idea that somehow African Americans were less qualified, less knowledgeable, less skilled, or whatever, was perpetuated mm-hmm. in a sense. So in that one myth that was so strong under segregation and so pernicious gets a renewed lease on life in a sense mm-hmm. with this unexamined consequence of a policy. Mm-hmm. So I think there are cases like that where there has been a carryover from right. earlier times. But the ones I look at much more are sort of actual dynamics, interracial dynamics. Under segregation, of course, there were all kinds of rules about eye contact and pedestrian behavior and such, where if a black and a white person were walking along a sidewalk, it was just always expected that a black person would defer to the white person. And as you all know, if there was eye contact made between a black man and a white woman, that in some parts of the South could spell the death of that black man. So the etiquette was so crucial, and we like to think of it now as etiquette as a very minor aspect of life, really inconsequential. But I think, in fact, these issues are hugely important to people, and it gives people a sense of where they are in the social realm, even if there is not a, if the consequence is not something as right. brutal as lynching. Still, it gives us a sense, sort of reinforces our sense of where everyone stands socially. Right. And I think now there are still expectations or unwritten guidelines that sometimes are very much turned over. So there is a common tendency in many realms for whites actually to be the deferential ones. And it can just be a look, a matter of a greeting, moving aside on the sidewalk and such. But again, what it carries over is something much deeper, and that is the idea that we all belong to a small social group, not the polity, not the, you know, really multivarious, wonderfully diverse country that many of us think we belong to, but it reinforces the idea we belong to these sort of smaller cultural mm-hmm. units. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it also reinforces the idea that you can separate democracy, a democratic posture to the world where you always think of everyone else as inherently your equal. You can separate that somehow from our everyday interactions.
If those things are true, and I think they are, then the obvious question might be, how much of this is being documented or talked about or studied in a scholarly way now? Because there's much written about race, but I don't think there's much written about this.
Yeah, I agree. There's so much written about race. Books pour out every day. But for some reason, this particular issue doesn't seem to gain much sustained scholarly interest or even sustained general interest. And I think that partly that's because, well, for one thing, of course, it's one of the reasons is that race, as I think every American at this point knows, has become a big business. Mm. And so many people are trying to get in on it while it's a hot topic and perceive it to be hot. And that often, you know, as we know from many other, seeing many other subjects explored, it it comes to pretty superficial stuff. But I think there's also a major problem in our writings on race, and that is that they often, I would say because of the legacy of the late civil rights movement in the late 60s and other cultural trends, they tend to be expressed in a therapeutic mode,
right,
as though somehow talking about race mm-hmm. means just sort of letting it all out.
Yeah.
But I don't think it leads to connecting with one another. I think usually it's just one individual letting it all out.
Elizabeth, I want to hold us on that point because it's an excellent one, and I want to go right to it.
Okay.
Before I do that, though, let me take a moment from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston C.A., and my guest today is Elizabeth Lash Quinn, Associate Professor of History at Syracuse University and a current fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Elizabeth, you have just made a very important point, and you actually mentioned it earlier, of this changes in the later era of the civil rights movement that, to use the phrase, seem to have a lot to do with kind of therapeutic notions of personal identity. That's a fascinating topic in and of itself, and we can't really do it justice in this short space of our conversation, but essentially, what do you mean by that? What changed in the course of the civil rights movement, and what do you think the effect of that change is on the topic we're talking about today?
Well, the civil rights movement changed drastically over the course of the 60s, so much that some scholars and some participants at the time refused to call what was going on in the late 60s part of the civil rights movement. They really thought the civil rights movement as such had ended and that a new phase had begun, and some people call it the Black Liberation Movement. And that's probably a pretty apt phrase, because liberation came to be associated with what some people criticize now as liberationism, where all you're concerned with really is freedom, mm-hmm. individual freedom, and not responsibility toward others.
The focus then turns toward the person's sense of who he or she is,
yes.
as opposed to what the community should be.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that instead of thinking about principles outside of one that one can be committed to for life and that have really intensely personal consequences, actually. But instead of that, people really turned to what they considered the personal realm and focused on identity and building identity. And it's all for a very understandable reason. It's undeniable that the racial etiquette of segregation and the whole fact of the abridgment of civil rights for so long in this country had damaged people's self-respect. But in the late 60s, the new stress on psychotherapy throughout the country, not just in interracial situations or racial situations, had steered that question away from a matter of self-respect, which one can build in a number of ways, and which ties into the building of community and the understanding of what community one belongs to a building of just self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And self-esteem is a much more superficial way of thinking about respect and identity. And so I think that the convergence of several cultural trends in the late 60s was absolutely catastrophic for mm-hmm. race relations, for African Americans, for the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And those trends would be the rise, the increasing popularity of psychotherapy as a way to understand the world, particularly superficial therapeutic techniques, not so much psychoanalysis, which can be a very profound way of thinking about an individual and his relation to the rest of society. But therapy as a kind of feel-good philosophy. Mm-hmm. That combined with the disasters that occurred in the civil rights movement, such as the death of Martin Luther King and that tremendous leadership that he provided, mm-hmm. and the assault on all sense that there should be rules or formality, that somehow formality itself was elitist, structure was elitist, mm-hmm. that coming from the counterculture and the student movement, I think all of those converged. I should say that the attack on formality actually was well underway well before
right.
the student movement. I don't want to...
But what you're saying essentially is that you know, three forces, the rise
yeah.
of psychotherapy, the death and loss of great leadership, and then finally the kind of assault on etiquette and notions of formality and structure. These things,
yes.
three things coincided
yes.
sort of very unfortunately
mm-hmm.
to prohibit what might have been a larger dialogue and a more honest one at just the point when it was needed?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And they also converged and produced new forms of trying to deal with race issues that I think set a kind of model for much of what came later. An example is the kind of encounter groups mm-hmm. that people like the psychiatrist Price Cobbs ran. He was in the field of psychology, but later and now is in the field of diversity training.
Mm-hmm.
And he and many other people decided that the way to deal with race relations by the late 60s and early 70s was as a psychological problem, that somehow it was inherent in human psychology to try to cast certain people out of the group. And this is a particular way of understanding racism that became pervasive in this mm-hmm. society since then.
But once again, what all of this seems to suggest is that, and this I guess is just a further expression of the therapeutic approach, this sort of letting it all out and letting it all out, particularly in terms of sort of internal hostilities and so forth. But all of that just I think objectively viewed seems to preclude any kind of larger, more positive notion of a, you know, an entire community trying to define itself and trying to discuss these matters. In other words, I don't know, where do you go from here? I mean,
right.
What's the possible, I mean, what is the predictable outcome of this kind of continued focus on race?
I think it continues the balkanization of people into smaller groups, unfortunately. But it also sort of remakes a kind of set of identities that don't necessarily mesh very well with many Americans' own personal experience. So it sort of creates this myth of African-American identity, and which many African-Americans now are clearly pointing out that they don't feel much of a kinship with. So it perpetuates the sense that there are all of these groups and there are these homogeneous cultures mm-hmm. that each group has. And so it denies the incredible diversity within groups and among groups.
Constraining yeah. then. I mean, it establishes yeah. a standard to which people are expected to adhere by virtue of what their skin color is or...
Right,
you know,
that's right.
Rather than who they are individually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's scary because if... say a white person has no real contact, no meaningful contact with a person of color, that white person might actually be exposed to blacks in general through something like a diversity training seminar or reading a book about that suggests how that person should behave in an interracial group or a novel or a film or something mm-hmm. that gives a sense of what black culture is all about. And so they get this information. It's kind of a social engineering or an education movement mm-hmm. that people who think they know better are trying to teach other people. And so someone who really has no exposure to someone of a group outside of his or her own suddenly has all of these wrong-headed ideas mm-hmm. drilled into their head. And that's going to affect interactions
right.
In the future. So it's a very pernicious cycle that it's very hard to get out of.
Indeed it is, Elizabeth, and that actually provides me with the notion for the concluding question of our conversation, because given what you've described, the obvious question is how can we possibly get to a better place? I mean, there seems to be a kind of a self-reinforcing dynamic here that just doesn't seem to be terribly hopeful about a larger dialogue. And yet it occurs to me that that larger dialogue is essential for the question of racial etiquette in the society. And perhaps it has increased urgency as the society gets even more racially complex in terms of new groups coming in and new expectations being expressed by them, and just the mosaic of American society changing practically even as we speak. So I suppose that is the question for the moment. What can break this cycle? What can turn us in a better direction? I would suspect that perhaps scholarship of the type you're doing might be a good place to start.
Well, I would hope that scholarly examinations could make a difference, but I think non-scholarly ones are just as important. At every level, I think what is crucial is something that is a crucial aspect of democratic life, no matter what the issue is or what the context is, and that is that we refuse to accept inherited wisdom that claims that it is wisdom at face value always. And that sometimes means having to go against the stream, having to be the only person in a particular setting to point out some very difficult reality, or perhaps just very quietly or subtly not to go along with a set of expectations that might be governing a particular social situation or a particular national conversation. So it means that if one sees jarring between certain expectations for behavior and democratic principles, that it has to be pointed out. I mean, it doesn't have to be pointed out in an angry, rude, you know, bellicose way that might start all kinds of new tensions and problems, but it needs to be brought to light. And so I think that certainly in the realm of the national conversation, we have to have more piercing, more courage, really. It would be nice to have more courage among our leaders, but also just every citizen. If there are expectations that are based on a double standard, there's no real reason why we should live by them, because that will teach our children the lesson that that's how we should live. It will teach our students, and it'll become habit forming as well.
That is an extremely helpful and hopeful answer. And I thank you very much for this conversation, Elizabeth Lashquin.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest was Elizabeth Lashquin, Associate Professor of History at Syracuse University. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Kirsten DeBelko. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes,